You learned the fundamentals from a Greg Kalk instructional video.
Yeah.
Where is the SRV influence in your playing?
Nashville, Guitar Town, that airport. They refuse to put a gig bag through the machine. They make you literally take everything out.
Was there a project or a tour you did where you thought, oh my God, if this doesn't work, I'm really putting a lot of money on the line?
Yes.
Today's episode is sponsored by Gator Cases. Guitarists, like any other musician, value the advantages of proper protection for their gear. Guitars, amps, effects, and accessories all need safe transport and storage. Luckily, Gator's got you covered. Ariel Posen the podcast. How are you doing? Thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure, man. I'm doing good. How are you?
Okay. You just released Mile End 3, and you say that this is the last album in the series. Why are you committing to that?
A couple of reasons. The Mile End thing, it was an experiment. It wasn't meant to be, you know, anything that takes away really from what I would consider my real records, where it's a lot more time and money that goes into, you know, and just like writing songs. And these are just projects where I just went for one night to a studio and improvised a bunch of ideas and hope that I would have at least 10 of them that sounded okay. And I'm grateful for it. It's been another total, like a beautiful, different avenue of expression for myself. And I'm grateful that a lot of people have dug it. But with each one I've done, the very first one was beautiful because I went in with no intention of it being anything other than some videos. That was great. When I decided, hey, let's do it a second time, I went in there and now I was comparing to something that, you know, the magic of just like, hey, no pressure, just go in and see. I had the pressure because I knew now what I was trying to do. And then the third time, it wasn't pressure. It was more like, how do I just make this different than the other one? So I feel like if I keep doing it, just for me personally, I think there's a ceiling to it, and I don't want to just overexpose it. I want to keep it as like, you know, all good things must come to an end. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to do other little side quests musically and kind of explore that improvisational and just more guitar-centric side of me, but it felt fitting to cap it at 3 for like the specific Mile End solo guitar thing.
How do you, when you go into record the next track, do you have an idea in your head, or do you kind of work a couple concepts out and then start improvising it? Or when you hit record, do you really have no idea what you were going to play?
Yes.
No, really?
To all of that. So sometimes it's hit record and then I just kind of just see what happens. And there's a lot of times where I go, hey, stop, like this, let me just start again, this sucks. But like I might hear or get an idea and I'll try it again. Again, the very first one was the most pure and authentic because there was something about the vibe and like the lack of pressure. I was just exploring, and that's, I think, why it felt so easy. I'd say 10% of what comes out on these solo guitar records is an existing song or idea. Like the last two I've done just a solo version of like a song of mine with lyrics and then another song with lyrics. So it's a mix, but like 95% of it, just sit down, see what happens and go for it. And I think my history of like when I was really starting to just build a profile online, I was touring a lot with bands and just like an active musician, but I had started doing a lot of demo, like guitar demo gear work for companies where they fly me down to wherever and go, record, okay, go. So I just started getting experience of like this ready, set, go, don't think about it experience where it's like, and I feel like everything is more authentic for me when I'm just in the moment kind of creating in that sort of environment. Nothing against composing something, but for me, that just, it started feeling really, really natural, and it, the un, like the uncertainty and like the parts of it that are uncomfortable are fun and inspire you going for things and making choices in the moment that you wouldn't normally make when it's every part is set in stone. You know what you're going for. So it's like a balance of all that stuff, you know?
Who, you made an Instagram post where you said that on the first one, some members of your team were like, I don't know if you should put this out. And then you were like, no, we're going to put this out. Who makes up your team and who tells you on the team that maybe you shouldn't put that out or you should put it out or whatever it is?
First of all, it wasn't as direct. It wasn't like, you shouldn't put this out. It was more like, oh, interesting. Or really? Are you sure you want to do that? You know, like there was no like pushback, but I had to kind of convince. It was my manager at the time and my distribution team / label services team. I'm not with a label, but they are responsible for putting all my music on all the streaming platforms and some physical distribution as well. So we often, you know, get together biweekly or like depends if there's a release and like make plans and you know, you got to live like months and months and months in advance. And yeah, I suggested it. Again, it was like lockdown time, 2021. So for me, it was like one of the most creative times in my life. Like I was in my prime for just being inspired to collaborate, to create, to do all this stuff because I just got into this great routine. I wasn't on a plane. I wasn't touring. I wasn't doing, you know, I was just home and everyone else was home. So like, I don't know. It was magic. And you know what? If it wasn't like that time, I think this whole thing never would have even happened to begin with. I would have never even gone to a studio and thought of doing this. So I was just feeling like experimental and I was like, you know what? My record Headway, which is my second record, came out at the beginning of that year and we did almost an 8-month campaign leading up to it. Couldn't tour it. So it was like, once we were finally touring in September of that year, let's support this with something. How about this solo improvised guitar record? And it didn't take convincing at all. Everyone was just like, okay, I see what you're saying. Hey, we're down. Whatever you want, let's try it. And I'm glad we did.
Hey, really quick, if you want some of the licks that Ariel is playing in this interview, plus a whole bunch of other great content, check out my Patreon linked in the pinned comment right below. All right, back to the interview.
Where do you think that record finds the audience? Because does it find the audience on Bandcamp or do people listen on Spotify and discover it there? Like, where does an album like that exist in the world?
The streaming services for sure. Because it's whether I like this or not. In fact, I was just discussing this with my manager as well. Is like it when I think of my Spotify or my Apple Music or whatever, you know, I'm thinking of songs and my albums, but it's all algorithmically, you know, it keeps changing. So whatever people are really listening to, that's what you're going to hear. So if you go to like a This Is Ariel Posen on Spotify, you're going to hear like a song of mine with lyrics, and then you might hear two solo guitar pieces, which honestly is not my intention, but it's fine. That's where it lives. I have people that come out to shows and go, I discovered you from the Mile End thing. The fact that you sing and do these songs, that was a bonus, but I'm here because I love the solo. So I just go, you know what? It's all good. Thank you for being here. But that's where it lives. It lives on the Spotify's, lives on the streaming, Bandcamp, I guess. And the special thing about each release was that, you know, I still print vinyl and CDs for all the albums for online and for tour. And just to keep some kind of exclusivity and like some something just like a special element about these records, I always did. It's not a crowdfunded thing, but it's like one of these websites where we're only going to print 300 or something like that. And if you don't order it on this run, we're never printing it again. And that's like the vibe I go for, which results in a lot of people asking to repress it. But that's what makes it special. That's what makes it unique. So it lives a little bit of everywhere, I guess.
I have a lot of guitar player friends of various degrees of success who really struggle to build their team and to find a manager and to find an agent. And if you took their social media following or whatever and compared it to an artist in another genre, it would be so easy for them to build a team and put something together. Have you struggled to build a team with what you do, or have the right players naturally shown up and helped out with what you need?
It's been a, it's been years and years of building a team, and you know, I'd like to think most artists are in the same position as me, where like you're protective of, it's your business essentially. But more so than that, you want to bring people on that care about this thing as much as you do and put in the same amount of effort, even though no matter what, all the people that are going to be on your team are going to be on other teams as well. And that's fine. But as long as when, you know, it's your time, they are putting in that effort. I've spent a lot of years self-managed for a couple of years, and there's pros and cons to it. Like, I like the transparency. I'm like a very details on it kind of guy. Give me the details, give me this, give me that. To a point, it's good for me because I like to be involved. I like to know what's happening, and I want to have say in what's happening too. But there has to be a balance in that. Sometimes it's just better to have someone else dealing with that, because at the end of the day, those years of, I guess, self-managing, I don't book my own show. I have like booking agents and all that other stuff. I couldn't do that. But just in terms of opportunities and advancing shows, or like talking with a label or talking with this opportunity or that, if I'm emailing most of the day, I'm burning out. And it makes me not be creative at all. So those years I find myself, like I was saying, COVID was the most creative time. It's like the complete opposite when I was just taking on everything. And my general rule is like, do everything you can until it feels like you're not doing a good enough job, or you're burning out, or it's just too much, and then have someone else do it. And that's kind of what I go for. And sometimes even before it gets to that point, I recognize, hey, I need to pass this off. I need to farm this out now. This is just taking too much out of me. Even on tour, I was tour managing as well, and I've now pushed that away so that I don't have to tour manage. I don't have to advance shows and like deal with this and that. And it's already relieved so much energy that I could be spending on performing or just relaxing even. So I think a lot of artists can do these things without a team to a degree, but you really, it's good to have people on your side to back you up. It's really tough to do it all on your own.
Have there been times where you've thought, okay, I'm at my max capacity, I need to bring someone on to do this, and maybe for that specific task, there wasn't enough revenue to justify bringing someone on, or it was difficult to find someone to come in and help with that task?
Yes. In fact, I feel like most times you start something like that, you know, whether it's a commission-based thing, or if you're starting to pay, you know, you're paying for a driver or a merch seller on tour that travels with you, that's a whole other hotel room. You know, will it break the budget? Maybe. Will it put me in the red? Potentially. Maybe it won't. But I know that I'll work at a better level. Everyone else will work at a better level, because now no one has to worry about those elements, the travel, the setting up merch, the selling merch, whatever. That's just an example. But things like that, sometimes it's worth the investment. And you have to remember, being a band, being an artist, it is a business. And, you know, if you really believe in what you do and you believe in the art, which I know we all do as artists, it's just not always easy to just let the art speak for itself all the time. But you have to invest in the business too. And no one else is going to, you know, do this kind of spend for you. So sometimes you just have to try things out, and you have to, it's uncomfortable financially, it might be a bit straining, but you will notice if you can make it happen, you see the importance of just having people having your back and having a team, you know?
Was there a project or a tour you did early on where you thought, oh my God, if this doesn't work, I'm really putting a lot of money on the line here financially?
Yes. I mean, I still have like that still happens sometimes where, you know, we did a tour. We did a tour a year ago to almost to the day. We went to Europe, which we do often, annually at least, maybe twice a year. And I just wanted to get rid of all the travel, like the driving. And I wanted to take a 9-show tour in like Ireland, Switzerland, Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. And I wanted to do it in like 9 or 10 days. And my agent was like, I'll book it for you, but how are you going to do that? And I was like, we're just going to fly everywhere. And I'm just going to get us backline everywhere. And it was a lot of work and stress because some of these places, I had pals who could supply stuff. And then some of these places, I just had to rent. And, you know, flying in Europe is a lot cheaper than it is in North America most of the time. But it's expensive. And I knew that I was just like, you know what? Is this the smartest move? Maybe not. But I'm trying it out. And if it fails, it fails. If it doesn't, and you know what? It worked. And we were all very happy because our energy was high. We always had time to relax because the flights weren't too early. And every flight is like 45 minutes. And it was great. And you know what? I was worried on the financial side, and it didn't really affect it. In fact, it was all a success. When I first started touring as a solo artist, I'd be lucky to get a few $100 at a room, you know? So I would just fly around by myself and, you know, I'd only have to get one hotel room, one flight for me. Sometimes I'd have to rent a car, I guess, but I would just use a local band for everywhere I played. And this consisted of either friends of mine or some people that were recommended to me. And, you know, that was when I really started learning how expensive touring is. And I had plenty of experience of a sideman just being like, here's your flight info, here's your this info, we're going to be away. Okay, I just show up and do the thing. But when you have to actually put it together, dang. That's why, you know, I got to tell the people that are watching, if you like a band, go see their show, because it really makes a difference. But when I started, yeah, I was like, if this is going to be what my touring life is, dang, I don't know if I can make this work. But, you know, you got to keep working at it and sell more tickets, and then it starts, you know, it's just a vicious cycle, but you learn to build it over time, and it's different for everyone. Some people it's a slow burn, some people it's an immediate jump each time. It's going to be different for everyone.
What's your philosophy when you're flying to fly with guitars? Do you check them? Do you bring them on and put them on? Like flying around Europe, a million, airplanes, yeah. I'd be just worried about the guitars.
I might get some confusion from this. I've done it all. So like I've flown with like the Pelican case, fancy, check it. I've done check a hard case. I've done the gate check. I've done the bully your guitar on board and make it fit. I've done the bully your guitar on board and let them put it in the closet in the first class. I've done it all. And I'm at a point now where, I mean, I fly a lot. I fly almost 100 flights a year. Most of the time a guitar is with me. Most of the time it's two guitars on my back. Like I do a double bag. And I'm at a point where I really don't care about the flight anymore, this sounds really bad. If the guitar is going to get a little ding on it or a scratch, that doesn't really bother me. Obviously, if the neck gets snapped in half, that's bad. And if it gets lost, that sucks too. But I've had guitars lost, gate checked. I've had them lost, checked. There is really no good way to do it. So I'm at a point now where I kind of say a little prayer. I'm not a spiritual guy, but I say a little prayer and I just check it in a mono double bag.
Yeah. Wait, in a soft bag you check it?
Yeah. And I'll tell you why. Every time when I used to tour and check instruments in a hard case, they get trashed. Any impact takes it much harder. Any this or that, it's a lot easier for the instrument to get hurt, and all the cases get destroyed over time. You've got to tape up your latches and stuff, and they all break off eventually. And the impact of something actually happening, I think is worse. This is just based on my own experience and my own opinion, of course, but a soft case like the mono thing, this is not an ad, but, you know, their commercial is like they throw it off a building or whatever.
Yeah, right.
And I should say this. I'm not traveling with like a Les Paul or a 335 style guitar, guitars that are at an angle that are very much prone to breaking. That I don't think I would do. But with a Fender guitar, they can take quite the beating, in my experience. And it's not even about the beating. I actually just feel like they're more protected in a bag like that. If there's impact, if there's a drop, at least there's like a softer blow rather than like this hard thing going on. Again, my experience, my opinion, but I've done this a lot now. And when you're walking around airports and you're tired and you're thinking about a million things, having these two guitars on your back and a backpack,
it sucks,
dude. And yeah, I feel like there was a time where like I'd throw my back out every 2 months on tour.
Just from
specifically from those guitars. Yeah. Which are not heavy guitars. Yeah.
I'm about to check a hard case next week and see.
Well, what guitar is it?
I've got, well, nothing. See, the thing is, I have guitars.
What style guitar?
A Tele and a Strat are going to be in double bag.
Okay. And you're flying out of where?
Nashville to LAX.
Okay. So here's like just a pro tip from my experience. Every airport is kind of different too. And I've really been getting tired I've just been getting sick of dealing with, you never know what you're going to get. Some desk when you check in might go, no problem. Oh no, sir, you have to check that. You have to do this. Or you get to security and they go, oh no, that doesn't fit. We need to rip everything out of your case. So like I live in Montreal. If you fly domestic and you bring a bag on, they're really bad for that. But if you fly international, just like to US, they don't care. So it's very strange. But Nashville, I know for a fact that airport, Music City, Guitar Town, they refuse to put a gig bag through the machine. They make you literally take everything out and then they make you hold the guitar in front of everyone. It's like kind of degrading and embarrassing. And I can't believe out of all cities, that's a thing. So like,
this is the bane of my existence. And I find myself too, I'm always of the mindset, like you have to be nice to everyone. You have to be polite. I find myself getting so cranky at these TSA people who are doing their job in that moment because I'm like, this is like, you don't know how to hold my guitar. They end up holding it. I go, can you give me that? Like, it's a nightmare.
But in Nashville, this is like the TSA pre-line.
That's what I'm saying.
Line.
Yes.
So it's the one line where they're supposed to be. Yeah, we trust you, you know, like put it in the machine. So with all those kind of frustrating experiences, it's just like, dude, I'll just check it.
That's what I'm doing.
The only times I won't check it is if I'm on some kind of flight or route where, you know, let's say you got to stop through Chicago to go somewhere and you only have an hour, which always recommend not taking those flights because you never know. So like, what if I make it, but the guitar doesn't? So like, I'll gate check or muscle it on in a situation like that. But yeah, if you travel a lot too and you start to get a couple of complimentary bags, you know, I'm just like, hey, I'm gonna check it, say a little thing up there, hope it makes it, and we'll see what happens otherwise.
I think it's a myth too about loosening the strings. I never loosen the strings.
Me neither.
That's such a myth, right? I don't know where that got started. That's unbelievable.
I don't know if it's a myth. I do understand why you would do that, but it's already going through so much. It's going through a temperature change. It's experiencing all these things. Like, is doing that one thing really going to change that much? It might. It might not.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't.
I love this idea, changing the topic a little bit. You mentioned this, I think, in an interview with Greg Koch, that when you were a kid, you were trying to learn Stevie Ray Vaughan, and you learned kind of the fundamentals from a Greg Koch instructional video.
Yeah.
Well, do you remember what that video was like? Or like, where is the SRV influence in your playing? Like, what do you think about?
Well, I mean, I like just everybody else. I think the first time they heard Stevie Ray Vaughan, if you were like 16 or 17, you were like, or at any age, really, but that's just the age I was at. It came from just finally, I don't know, Scuttlebutton or one of those songs. And it just, at the time, it took me on a path of like, I need to take music and guitar seriously now. I thought I was good, but I'm nothing. I have just been playing songs I like. I've been jamming with my friends. That inspired me to put my head down, put in the time, put in the practice, the 10,000 hours, all that shit. But once I was kind of getting into it, I think I would have been at like a record store at the time. Yes, a record store. HMV in Canada, maybe it was, or maybe it was even a Walmart. And I just saw this SRV Licks video, which I was like, oh, sweet. That's an like, this is before YouTube was like what it is now. Now you can just Google like literally anything you want to learn. And not only is what you're looking for going to be there, but there's too much of it. You can't even decide. So I bought this DVD or whatever. And yeah, it was Greg. And he's exactly how he is now, just like over eccentric and hilarious. And it was awesome. He's like nailing all this stuff. So I had to tell him that. I mean, Greg's a friend now. We've known each other for years and years, but I don't remember when we did that pod, probably was like 3 years ago or something. But yeah, what? So funny. I love stuff like that. That's like the full circle, beautiful things in life, you know?
What were the big takeaways, though, from that video or from SRV? Like, what are the big takeaways in your playing that you think you took away from SRV?
I think just the focus on his dynamics and the feel, and like there's a time to be really aggressive. There's a time to be really soft and delicate. It's not so much about the notes. Like, he's got iconic licks that you hear someone do the da 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 da. It's like, oh, Stevie Lick.
Yeah.
But it's not what he was playing as much. You know, sounds generic because I feel like I say this all the time, but it was how he was playing that really spoke to me. And it was just the little nuances with the volume knob and the dynamics and the feel and the aggression. And obviously his sound. Everyone wants his sound. But I never wanted to like just be a Stevie clone. I'm not. I'm that's not what I do. It's not, even if I tried, I couldn't. But there's an aura around him. I think a huge part of it is that we didn't really get right when he got into his prime. Unfortunately, it ended. I can't even imagine if he was around today still the kind of stuff he'd be doing and how that would have even inspired and changed all of us guitar players going forward. But I think just that general aura is what spoke to me and every other guitar player that's been inspired by him. It wasn't so much like that video of Licks. I mean, I probably saw that a year after already being into Stevie, and it was just kind of like a bonus thing, like, oh, that's sweet. And it's like on sale for $4. Like, why don't I just buy this, learn a few more licks? Why not? But that's generally, I'd say, and with most of my favorite musicians, there's elements like, sometimes it's their phrasing or it's their sense of melody and their choices. But the things that really speak to me the most about all musicians, all instruments, is the nuance. It's like how they're doing it rather than what they're doing. And it's usually feel and dynamics and like the things that you don't really see on paper, you know?
How do you practice those things to incorporate them into your own playing? Do you just listen back to yourself a lot on gigs and try to make micro adjustments, or how do you try to capture that energy?
That is a great way. I did that from the very beginning. I would record myself practicing. I would record every gig I did. And it was a matter of getting things to sound like they do in your head when you're playing. So like, you know, when you play something and you're like, I think this is great. It's sounding like how think it is, and then you listen back and it's like, oof, it's not.
What is that? Why are we so bad at knowing how we actually sound? Like, so many gigs, and then sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes you think you sound like crap and you listen back and you go,
great.
Oh, that's fucking amazing. Like, I never know how I sound on the gig.
That's what
I listen back.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that. I think it's just experience. It's like, you know, you go to a party and you look in a mirror, like you went to dinner right before the party, and you look at, and you're like, oh, shit. I got some lettuce in my tooth there. I'm glad I was just kind of self-aware and noticed that. And it's a matter of training yourself to, first of all, be relaxed and comfortable. And like, you don't want to think about this, of course, when you're playing. But after you do it enough times, it's a matter of just being so content with what you're doing that it doesn't, something that feels bad when you listen back actually did feel bad, or vice versa. Like, even like at the highest level, you're still going to have days where you thought you had a nice gig and you listen and you're like, ugh. Or vice versa. You're like, this is great. And you listen, it's like, this is horrible. But documenting yourself helped me a lot and still does. And honestly, experience. Like, if you can get on stage hundreds and thousands of times, there is no substitute for that. You know, like, you can sit at home and play and practice all day, but if you don't actually do what you're practicing in context to, like, actual music and, like, a song, whether or not it's with people, it's really hard to get into that, because there's a difference between practice and playing. You know what I mean? So I think once I felt like I spent enough time, which there's never enough time, working on fundamental things only for a while. You should still always do that, and so should I. I tried to turn my practice into playing so that everything I was practicing was in context of playing with a band, context of playing specific songs, being in this scenario, so that when I got up on stage, and I'm fortunate because I started gigging when I was like 14. I started like very early playing on stage with people that were older than me too, kind of giving me like a nudge, like, hey, you rush a lot. You should watch out for that. Or like, don't put so many notes in your chord. You don't need to, like, okay. You know, like, I was getting a lot of good intel right away, which I'm so grateful for. But I just started building that awareness. And I'm not saying I figured it out. There's still a lot of work to do. I'm always kind of working on it. But as much as you can make your practice feel like really playing, then it's going to be a lot easier when you're in that situation, you know?
Can you demonstrate, I saw an interview where you were talking about with the Robin Ford influence in your playing, and you were talking about altered scales and how for you, sometimes just grabbing an interval, like the right interval instead of the whole scale, can really get that sound or outline what's happening. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like how do you think about the altered scale in that way?
Yeah. Do you want me to show you with a guitar?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the altered scale is like a pretty... It's kind of not like a very... Can you hear that okay?
Yeah, totally.
It's not like a super musical sounding scale, like a major scale. You know what I mean? Like, it's not quite as intuitive or instinctual to you, so I feel like a guy like Robin started making it really accessible, because when there's so many good notes in the altered scale that could be used as like a passing note, you know, like you have a sharp five that goes great to a four to play the three of the four chord, or there's a three obviously that can go straight to the four, there's a flat seven that can go down to the four, or like the three of the four chord, which would be the six. I'm talking in relation to the root. This has gotten really nerdy really fast.
Yeah, we're good. We're good.
Yeah. And, you know, the flat nine, which is also a transitionary chord that you can go to the five of the four chord, or with a couple extra notes, you can get to that third of the four chord again. So he'd be the king, and I'm sorry, I don't want to try to replicate Robin Ford. I'm not going to sound like him, but essentially... And he uses the diminished scale a lot, you know, that whole thing. But in a real simple way, he'd be like, so this is just simplified without doing it yet. not the greatest example, but to the four chord, you could hear where it's just.
Yes.
I could have landed on the five of the four chord. I think I went all the way to the three of the four chord. Yeah, just like those little things. It's even nicer if it's simpler, like. That's like a very jazzy, just diminished arpeggio. Like, I'm not an expert, I should say, but I've taken what really spoke to me about it, and I've just tried to, like, expand on that without getting too technical or too jazzy with it. I love that, but whenever I'm, like, stoked on something, it's a matter of trying to make it accessible for myself, like, just sounding accessible so it's not, like, a move or a stunt, but just something that makes sense in the context of like the song or the solo. You know what I mean? Like not making it like show-offy, but making it just, it was the right thing to play.
So what unlocked it for you even just a little bit? Was it breaking it down into the intervals and sort of the key notes to target and then working that into transitioning to the four chord?
That was a big part of it. I started with learning all these scales, like front to back, on every string and every key, and then it was the same thing with learning all the chord voicings and chords. I bought like one of those chord encyclopedias. This is like before I even got into like the altered scale, and I remember getting a chord encyclopedia, and it was like, okay, C major 7, C6, okay, C7. First one was major 7. I don't know if I said 7 or major 7. So I'd be like, okay, those are a few easy ones. Why don't I try a different one? And then it'd be like F, major 7. F, dominant 7, F6. And I'd be like, wait, why isn't it all the same? Obviously now I know that. So like, I felt like I was treating all these chords as licks and it was not helping me learn any of it. And then I realized, wait a minute, if I just figure out what makes all these chords, and if I learn the neck, and if I just kind of learn the triads or the intervals, then I can just find all these voicings myself. I can find, if I'm an F, if it's a major 7, I can just find all these different voicings myself instead of just like relying on memorization, because it's just taking these three or four chords and just endlessly repeating them in every key, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what helped me. And going to licks, or sorry, not licks, like these scales, like the altered scale. If you, like I said, it's not the most intuitive or musical scale. Like it's half diminished, half whole tone. Take any of those scales and it's like, how do I make melody out of these? So I was just like, what's the interval? What, like each interval's a color. And if you can start to identify that note or color with something like green sweatshirt as consistent like that, then you start to know how to use it. And that's what really started to help me. To this day, it helps me. And I try to tell people who are working on just getting to know the guitar better or like know the fretboard, like work on your ear training. I don't have perfect pitch, but I have pretty good relative pitch now. And I hear these intervals like they each have their own purpose and their own job. They each do a thing in any key, and it's all the same in any key. Like that kind of stuff is the most important stuff, like to consistently work on for myself, because it's like a skill that you can train yourself up to do, and you have to keep that muscle sharp and strong. And then once you, like the reason we struggle in music or anything is when we don't fully understand how something works. And when you get into why and how it works, then it starts to make sense, hopefully. And then you just keep getting deeper and deeper with it and exploring different ways of repurposing that thing that you're trying to do, ideally into like in infinite ways, you know?
Is it crazy that, like, when I had Corey Wong on the show, I said, Corey, isn't it crazy that you have your own thing, your own style that you do? And like, there are so many amazing guitar players that are unbelievable, but just don't have their own thing. And I feel like you've kind of tapped into something with the way you're always kind of tuned down. You play with these very thick strings, and it gives this very unique tone. And it's like, isn't that crazy that you stumbled upon that and made that your thing? Because there's like, you could be a great player and not have a thing, but when you hear yourself play, it's so unique and so distinct. Isn't that crazy that you, like, isn't that nuts that you stumbled upon this thing that's a little bit different than what every other guitar player does?
Yes and no. I mean, yes. I mean, it's everyone's goal to have, you're calling it a thing. I would call it like having your own voice.
Yes.
I think my voice, yeah, I guess I'm known for like doing like some of the baritone-y range stuff. But in my opinion, and most people don't realize, is they hear me play and they think I'm always down-tuned, but I'm not. I'm just in standard tuning. I think it's, you know, a part of it is the slide, a part of it is the sense of like harmony choices I go for, and like my rhythmic style. Like, it's more so like my feel and the dynamics and like these nuances that I was talking about. I think that's like a huge part. Yes, like slap delay and like big fuzz sounds and low. Yeah, of course, that's a big part of it. But the essence of it are those nuances that I was telling you about 20 minutes ago that I think identify my sound the most. And I think everyone has it, like a voice. It's just a lot of people don't know how to fully be comfortable with just completely tapping into it, because everyone compares, especially now in this day and age of social media. You know, you look at someone else who does something similar to what you do, and you're like, oh, that sounds better than how I do it. I must be doing it wrong. Okay, well, I'll keep working on sounding better than that person. That's not you trying to sound like you. So like sounding like you is doing the opposite. Like I just don't care anymore. I'm so, it's not that I'm confident. I'm just content with like my abilities, my limitations. And that's what makes me me. You know, if you ask me 10 years ago, if I was like nervous that like a hero of mine would come to a gig, I'd be like, fuck yeah. And I'd probably completely change the way I play to cater to what I think they'd want to hear. Like if Stevie Ray Vaughan was going to come to my gig, I would probably start playing all my Stevie-isms, because I'd be like, that's how I'd connect to him, right? And it's like, no, that's the opposite of what someone like that would want to hear. They want to hear you. So like we did the Crossroads Festival a year and a bit ago, which was like a crazy honor. Everyone that's there is there because they have a thing. And it's not that I didn't care. I was so grateful to be there and so excited, but I was not nervous at all. I was just like, I'm the only me here. Does that mean is that a good thing or a bad thing? No, it's just, the only thing I'm the best at is being myself, and I'm cool with that. And we're here because that's what I do. And who cares? Who cares if everyone's watching? Who cares if no one's watching? This is just what I do. And it brings a lot of peace. It doesn't mean that you have to put less work in, because you should put as much work as you can into developing yourself and keeping everything sharp and keeping your skill just at the highest level you can. But it has nothing to do with what anyone else is doing. It's like, to a degree, living in this peaceful little bubble of like your own sonic endeavors, if you will. And it's great to still take inspiration from what everyone else is doing that you think you connect with, but blocking out the noise, don't compare to others. Like the only thing you should compare to is how you played the day before, how you sounded the day before. And how do you really focus in on that? Document yourself, start listening to what you're doing. Instead of comparing to Joe Blow on Instagram, who's like playing a million miles a minute, but playing the same style you play, and it's making you feel bad, just compare to whatever you were doing the day before. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's how I think we should be just focusing our, like, and prioritizing our, I don't know if artistry would be the right word, but just, we need more voices, you know? We want to hear you. We want to hear what you have to say. We don't need to hear always the same thing. that a bunch of other people are already doing it. Like, don't be afraid of your uniqueness. Don't think that, like, because you're different, you're worse. Because you're different makes you unique. And you should really just tap into that and get to know it and get as comfortable as you can with it. Because we all want to hear it, truthfully.
Why don't more guitar heroes sing? Like, so many of them are just instrumentalists, and you've tapped into singing. Like, how'd you learn how to sing?
I just started singing. And in fact, I was a late bloomer. I was really kind of shy. So I didn't really start singing, like, into a microphone until I was like 16 or 17. I've always been a song guy. Like, I was brought up on the Beatles, and I'm a 90s kid. So I, like, my guitar heroes, again, like I said, I didn't hear Stevie Ray Vaughan until I was like 17, maybe. I started playing guitar when I was 8. And my parents are musicians. There's always music in the house. So when I was like 8 years old and starting to play guitar, it was like Nirvana, Green Day, Chili Peppers, Rage Against the Machine, Silverchair, Soundgarden, you know, a bunch of bands like that. That's what made me want to play guitar. It was like someone singing, fronting a band, and the guitar was just there to support the song. So I've always just had a connection to that kind of thing. Like, look at someone like a guitar hero to me, like a Jeff Buckley, like such a cool guitar player, so unique, but it's the songs. I could make a list of a million others, but after a while, like, I don't know, everyone has a different preference, but when you really look at it, everyone's amazing. Everyone's so good at their instrument. And
that's not true though. Some people suck. Not everyone's amazing.
But I'm talking about the people who are like
the people who are doing
guitar
it.
Heroes, you know? Yeah. Like, they're all great. They're all amazing. Some people are just in it for the playing, and that's what speaks to their soul. And for those people, that's how they express themselves the most. Some people were just brought up differently and brought up in bands, brought up on songs, and can sing or like writing songs. And, you know, the guitar is there to help emphasize the big picture. Like, the guitar, other than singing, is how I express my sound, of course. It's the most useful tool I have in the toolbox, but I just want to make music. I just want to make songs. And personally, I don't want to make, like, guitar music. Not because I think it's lesser than, but it's just not my upbringing of how I ingested music. It goes hand in hand with a song, and it goes hand in hand with singing. And it's not to say, like, I love improvising. I know a lot of people know me for improvising things and whatnot. That's a huge part of it too, but for me, it's just a balance. I don't want to do too much of only ripping. In fact, I think if I did a whole show of just solo, like just playing guitar, it would get really boring fast. And maybe that's just me being in my own head, but I find playing songs and being a guitar player is a perfect balance of the whole thing. So it's you're checking all the boxes instead of just one thing, so to speak.
I love your song Heart by Heart.
Oh, thanks.
That you play. And I love especially the part that you do in the chorus where it's just like a little shimmy of the slide. It's almost not even a part. It's just like a little, you just kind of wiggle the slide a little bit to give a little bit of texture over what you're singing. Can you kind of demonstrate maybe like a little bit of that riff, or kind of like, is that a brilliant concept of over what you're doing on the chorus, or is that kind of just come naturally to you?
Let me just make sure I know the part you're talking about. I actually have the sound right here, which is hilarious.
What is the sound? Because it's a great sound.
Well, it's some slap, it's an overdrive, and it's the Eventide H9, like that envelope filter sound. So it's kind of like that blooming, you know?
Yeah.
So the chorus. Is that the part you meant?
Yeah, no, that's because it's just a little bit. It's just a little wiggle. That's
a little wiggle.
It that's basically, you know, copping for the entire chorus.
It is. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, just a little thing in between that I think when I wrote it and maybe when I demoed it, I just did it. Yeah.
How That's do you fun. Think about playing that? Maybe it's not such a crazy concept, but even there, you were sliding up with the slide and then grabbing the bass note with your, I think, your pointer finger.
Yeah.
How, like, or your, I guess, your middle finger. How did you develop those ideas?
I think just in the moment, trying it out, and now I don't even think about it. It's subconscious. I think I did it that way, like that. I know I could just go. But I think I went. Because I wanted to like make it sound like it's technically still slide on the chord, which it is, because there's a difference. There's no vibrato. And I wanted, it's sometimes nice to have that. And it's so like subconscious now, I truly don't think about it. I just, these impulse decisions just happen. And I think it just comes from experience. that is what it is.
What's the intro riff of the song? Can you play the intro riff a little bit?
Yeah, it's actually in the wrong tuning.
Ah.
But that's essentially it.
Yeah.
If I play it in the wrong key, it's this. So it's in a G shape kind of thing. Yeah, but it's an F. So on the, I play it on a baritone, a capo, the third fret. So it's like playing it in F. So it would technically be D standard. If you play it in D standard, you could play it in G like that. Tab's on my website, just saying. But
tab, go to the website. If this has inspired you to learn it, go to the website and get the tabs.
Or don't.
Yeah. Or don't. Or learn it yourself, or contribute to the tabs. What's been unsaid? You're about to be on the road with Ash Sohn doing a couple dates. You're doing New York, right?
Yeah, we're just doing a one-off.
Oh, it's just a one-off. It's just that.
Yeah, so, I mean, Ash is a legend. We all know he's wonderful. We've become friends the last few years. He played on an EP of mine. He played on the song Spare Tire that Corey and I did. And I've played on a few things of his music. We've all just like gone back and forth playing on each other's stuff. And we've always talked about wanting to do something. So we were on tour in the UK in October, and we were playing in Cambridge, which was fairly close to Norwich, where he lives. And I went to his studio, and he never has people over at his studio. So it was like a very hilarious, he's like, oh, sorry, man, I'm not used to doing a setup here for more than one person. And we just hit record and did a bunch of jams, see what happens. And we kind of like the mile end, hilariously, we're talking about like putting that to rest and exploring new ways of expressing that, not a muscle, but like that other sense of creativity. And we have a bunch of tracks from it. It ended up being great. A lot of it is on like our Instagrams. You could see the clips of us playing. And he's on tour right now with Snow Patrol, and he just got a couple days off, and it just made sense. Like, let's do a show. So we're doing a show at NYC. But yeah, other than that, we're on tour. We have some Canada dates in March, and there is much more to come. The year is just, I'm kind of in the downtime because I'm working on my new record at the moment, which I'm very excited about. But once that's out, I'll be back. We'll kind of be everywhere again doing that whole thing.
Ariel, thank you so much for taking the time. Can I trouble you? Can we go out on a little Mile End inspired improvisation? Could be 20, 30 seconds.
Oh, sure.
Something. Can you just give us a little mood to go out on?
Sure, man. Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for coming on.
We'll see you in Nashville when we're there, maybe.
When are you coming to Nashville?
Don't know yet.
I'll be there.
It'll be sometime at the end of the year.
If I'm not on the road, I'll be at the show.
Actually, I'll be in Nashville for Corey's camp in August.
Oh, yeah.
You should come hang.
I might
Come
be here
hang
at
for
that.
that. It's a fun,
I think
it's a
I'll be
fun
here at
hang.
that. I love it.
Yeah, hit one of us up. I'm sure it'd be no problem.
Okay,
It's
amazing. I
quite the
will.
hang.
I've
Yeah.
heard it's great. I've never gone. I gotta go. This is gonna be the year
There's
I'm
only
gonna
been
go.
one. There's only been
It was
one.
last year, the syncopation camp syncopation or that isn't that what it
Syncopated summer camp, yeah.
syncopated summer camp.
Yeah, it's a
That's where I
blast.
need to be this August, as well as
Yes.
everyone listening.
That's right. Okay,
Okay,
here we go.
Ariel Posen, improvised jam. Here it is. Ariel Posen on the podcast. I love watching you play. You are so great. I've never seen you live,
Thanks,
but I
man.
love the videos. I love seeing it on Instagram. You just have such a calmness in your playing and authority, and it's not too in your face, but it's still so confident, which I love.
Thanks, man. Appreciate that.
I hope to see you live in Nashville or wherever else on the road.
Like I said, hit me up if you see us in town, or I'll just let you know too. Be great to connect in person. Come on out.
Absolutely. Stay safe out there, and we'll see you next time. Thank you
Hey
so
man,
much.
you bet.